Attention, please. Would Logan Air passengers please proceed to the aircraft?
Fly with me. Oh, won't you fly with me? We'll fly off to the island and then watch the setting sun.
Hello, I'm Jom Ellis, and welcome to Logan Air's Flight Log, where I get to go behind the scenes of the UK's largest regional airline to find answers for your questions and discover exactly what it takes to keep Logan Air in the air and put all that on the air. This time out, I'm joined by Ronan Milne, head of training at Logan Air. Tell us a bit about yourself, Ronan. What do you do?
Hi, John. Well, I'm the head of training at Logan Air. So my responsibility is to look after the initial and the recurrent training for approximately 300 pilots now and 150 cabin crew.
Wow. Okay. So when you say the training and recurrent training, what does that involve exactly?
When somebody joins the company, they go through a kind of barrage of initial training to get them up to the standard that that we require at Logan Air before they're released to fly the line and fly with our passengers. And on top of that, they have a very dense program of recurrent training, which is basically continuing training throughout their career. We have a range of about 12 or 14 different ground subjects that the pilots and cabin crew go through on a yearly basis. They're trained and then tested in those elements. And then on top of that, they carry out a range of other additional checks. So they go through what we call a line check. So they're assessed and debriefed on their ability to just do their day job, essentially. And that happens sometimes every 6 months when somebody first joins, and then after they settle into it every year. And then the pilots on top of that do even more training. So they go out to one of our full flight simulators and do a 2-day assessment in the simulator. Every 6 months they do that, in fact. So the pilots in particular go through a very rigorous regime of continuing assessment and continuing training to develop their skill set and ensure that that if any of their skills do fade, we get them back up to the standard that they need to be as quickly as we possibly can.
Forgive me when I ask this question. When you say there are 300 pilots and 150 cabin crew and you're responsible for training, is the training a one-to-one thing? It can't be. There must be some sort of class situations as well, is there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's first of all, I'm not solely responsible. I have a very dedicated team that I work with in headquarters here in Glasgow. I have a team of three full-time members of staff that work tirelessly on the administrative side of it. And then on top of that, I have about 55 or 60 different pilot and cabin crew trainers whose main job essentially is a member of flight crew. So they're a pilot or a cabin crew member that fly on a day-to-day basis, but they also do training and checking responsibilities as well. So they're really the guys that go out and do the hard work, and I'm just the one that that sits there and reads the reports and makes sure that that everything you know fits the bill.
You're the headmaster and you delegate. I get it.
Delegation is the name of the game.
What's your own background?
I've been at Logan Air for 20 years now. In fact, just last week. And
congratulations.
Before that, thank you very much. Yeah, before that, I was actually a baker. So my entire family are in the baking industry for the last five generations, since 1919, in fact. And I was the black sheep of the family, I guess, because both my parents were in the business, and now all my older brother and both my younger sisters are in the family business as well. So I've fled the nest.
I have to ask, do they resent you for leaving the family business, or are they okay with it?
I'm not sure. They tend to say that I'm the favorite, but I'm not entirely sure why I'm the parents' favorite when I was the one that got kicked out and the rest of them all worked together on a daily basis.
Well, that's maybe why you were literally allowed to fly the nest and go into aviation. When did that start then?
Certainly we have very different jobs now, that all of us, and they in a family business, they put some absolutely horrendous hours in, and I generally don't really like night shifts. That's starting in the middle of the morning and working early starts and not something that work for me particularly. So the fact that they get to they have to do that almost every single day, I couldn't do. The odd early shift is fine, but I like the mix and the breadth that I do here. Okay. So it's not always a 3 o'clock in the morning start at Logan Air, thankfully.
And do they still invite you around for Christmas?
Yeah, we were just making plans for this Christmas actually. Oh, so we're all on excellent terms. terms, I think, probably because I work about 60 miles away. But
okay, well, I don't want a sob story coming through in this podcast. That would be horrific. You got into flying, though, so you were with the family business, but you got into flying, I understand, when you were about 16.
Yeah, so I was about, in fact, I was, I just turned 16, and my father got me a trial flying lesson, a 30-minute flying lesson at Dundee Airport.
Cool.
And I went off and I did that, and had just a fantastic 30 minutes flying around Dundee and over Fife and seeing where I lived. And it was just the most magical experience. It pretty much changed the trajectory of what I'd been planning to do at that point. And, you know, at a reasonably young age, I didn't have a very fixed idea of what I wanted to do. But from that moment on, I had a pretty good idea. And from there on, it just took on a whole new kind of... what should I say? From there on, it basically, you know, turned into a passion, essentially, for me. So I, at that point, decided I was going to get my private pilot's license. So I started training for that when I was 16, and then for about a year until I was 17. And then at that stage, I was leaving school and had basically decided that at that point on that I wanted to be an airline pilot. So I started doing all the training and set off essentially to go and do my commercial pilot's license, which is a huge undertaking. I hadn't appreciated at that age quite the undertaking it was, but extremely glad that I did it now.
When you say set off to do that, was that here or did you have to go somewhere else for that?
There was a range of places. Essentially, I did my private pilot's license at Dundee and then decided that the best place to go and do my commercial pilot's license was at a flying school down in the south of Spain. So when I was 17, just 17 and a half, 17 three quarters, I moved off, packed my bags, moved off to the south of Spain and was down there for about a year and a half in the end, training and essentially came back to Scotland in 2001 with my commercial pilot's license and ready to be employed. But that was unfortunately in October 2001. And many of you will probably remember that in September 2001, there was a terrorist attack that resulted 9/11, in a lot of, a lot of airlines, a global recession, and airlines not avoiding that, unfortunately, stopped recruiting. So I was back in the bakery for about a year, making donuts and scotch pies and all that lovely stuff.
With your commercial pilot's license, yeah.
With a commercial, yeah, probably the most overqualified donut fryer in the world, potentially. But it was great fun to have a little bit of a break and kind of regroup. And I was furiously sending out applications to every single airline. I've still got an envelope at home, actually, with about 50 or 60 rejection letters from airlines that had sent letters to me to say we're not looking for pilots at the moment.
You eventually got into Loganair then. What was the appeal there?
That was back in 2003, and they hadn't recruited, I don't think, since 2001. Mm-hmm. Certainly they hadn't recruited pilots, and I had been firing applications out to every single airline in the hope that I would attract some interest, and Loganair was one of the first to invite me to interview. So I came here to Glasgow, not very far from where I'm sitting just now, and I did my interview, a very nervous 20-year-old being interviewed for his first airline job, and managed to impress them enough for them to offer me a job. So I started as a first officer back in September 2003, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Did you think you'd be there for 20 years?
No, I don't think so. It was certainly, if you'd asked me back then, I didn't really have a defined plan in my head, but I had a kind of idea of the options or the trajectory that it would take. I didn't expect that Loganair would be able to offer me what it did when I first joined. But I have to say, every single turning point, Loganair's just been such a fantastic provider of interesting and, you know, rich experiences. And that is really the thing that that keeps me here, to be honest, is the wide and varied breadth of things that we do on an almost daily basis.
Here's an interesting question, and I mentioned it because you brought up the baker thing and that your family had done this for generations. So you come from a family business. How does that compare to being around Loganair? Because I get the feeling Loganair has a very much family vibe as well. Is it similar?
Yeah. I think that's probably one of the draws, to be honest, although I've never really thought about it until now. But it's probably that family atmosphere that reminds me of working from, you know, from the age of 10, I worked in the bakery during summer holidays and stuff. And, you know, and you would walk through any door in the building and you would know the person. And it's very similar here at Loganair. Even, you know, phoning up our operations control, I can just say, hello, it's Ronan. And they know who it is. And they're not asking you for your staff number or something like that you hear very,
absolutely.
The majority of my friends that also fly for other airlines, you know, that's the first thing they have to do is read off their 5-digit staff number so that the person knows who they're speaking to, you know. So it's definitely has a family atmosphere. And that's without a doubt one of the big draws for me at Loganair.
You know, karma is going to come full circle when one of the pilots that you've trained says, actually, you know what, I want to go off and become a baker. when did you make the switch from flying to training, and why?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a gradual process, actually. I mean, I spent a relatively short period of time as a first officer and a senior first officer, got my command, and then been a captain for maybe 5 years, 5 or 6 years, I got the opportunity to become a line training captain, which is kind of the first rung on the ladder in the kind of training sense in aviation. And that's training new pilots who've just joined and gone through all of their initial training. It's the very last phase of the training that they do, which is flying flights with passengers on and just having somebody there, you know, holding their hand essentially. Mm. And I did that for about 5 or 6 years, and then basically slowly worked myself up, got into instruction for the initial training, and then became an examiner for our recurrent training and then our initial training as well. And then the kind of the last training step really is the big head honcho's job. And that came up about 5.5 years ago. And I was asked, you know, if I was interested, and I had a long think about it. And well, I'm still here 5.5 years later, so there must be something drawing me in.
What is the most rewarding aspect of the job, do you think?
There's a lot of elements, to be honest. I think probably looking at people's faces once they've done something for the first time that they didn't think that they could do beforehand, I think. And that's a long road to get people to that point. Before somebody even joins Loganair, they've done probably, you know, at least a year and a half, if not 2 or 3 years of training to get to that point. And then they go through very rigorous training at Loganair to get to the point where they're just released as a regular line pilot. And quite often they join and they're a bit like a rabbit in the headlights. You know, there's a huge amount of work that they need to do. And we just take it step by step. We work through it. It is complex. It is difficult. It is complicated. But we break it down into small steps and, you know, place goals, you know, evenly across along the path, and they slowly pick up all of these little goals and realize that they're piecing it together and they can do it. And when you sign somebody off on their first ever line check and release them on their way to just go and fly the line unsupervised with no trainer sat there watching over their shoulder, that smile when you can say congratulations, you've passed your line check, you can shake their hand and look at them in the eye and see that big beaming smile, that's really the kind of nitty gritty. That's what I like the most.
And tell me about the challenges of the job.
There's a lot of challenges, to be honest. It's probably the best bit of the job and the hardest bit of the job. we have a lot of really complex parts of the business that need a lot of extra attention and detail that a lot of other airlines don't necessarily need to pay attention to. And we have things like beach landings at Barra and landing on the steep approach at London City Airport and landing on runway 33 and 15 at Sumber Airport is a particularly kind of complex approach as well. And that, to be honest, is the most challenging part. A lot of that requires additional approvals from the Civil Aviation Authority. It requires the pilots to have particular experience. It requires them to have additional training, initial training, and then recurrent training on top of that. And all of those kind of extra elements just make it it's more of a difficult achievement to get to, but once you achieve it, it's you know, the feeling of the satisfaction and the achievement is huge. So that's probably the best part of it, I would suggest, and the most challenging part of it.
I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, I'm trying to tot up all the air miles, like all the years of learning from just your basic, I'm going to learn how to become a pilot, through to the point where you can do all that stuff that you were talking about, the runway 33 in Shetland or Barra Beach. So you've had not only the initial training, but you've been all the way through the Loganair training, and you've been sort of marked ready to fly all these routes from start to finish. How long are we talking in terms of years and months and days?
Well, first of all, I wish I got air miles. That would be fantastic. If you could sort us out, John, that'd be fantastic.
Don't think my influence extends that far.
Pilots will generally we log hours. That's the kind of the main thing that we put in our logbooks, essentially, and we track that. And there's a few kind of milestones. So a private pilot might have 40 or 50 hours before they're allowed to be released. A commercial pilot, somewhere in the region of 200 to 250 hours. Our captains at Loganair need somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 hours of flying experience before they're allowed to be released to line as a captain. So it really depends. As a first officer or a co-pilot, generally, you know, they might have somewhere in the region of 200, 250 hours when they're experiencing their first landings in these places. Places like runway 33 at Sumbra, we have additional restrictions in place so that very inexperienced people aren't allowed to fly those approaches. London City, for example, you need all that additional training. But on top of all of that, it's a captain's only landing. So the first officers only get to watch and monitor what the captain's doing. But it'll always be the captain that lands at London City, just because of the complexity of it. And we need to make sure that it's our most skilled and most experienced people doing the job.
Not the uniqueness of Loganair, you think, that no 2 days are the same for a pilot?
It's just with a varied selection of things that we do, every single day is completely different. It was towards the end of last year, I landed on runway 33 at Sumbra, and about 3 hours later, I was landing at London City Airport. And it's, you just such a breadth of just, requirements and experience and knowledge, but also a complete breadth of the country. So it's
and extremes,
total extremes. And I have to say, it was a rare case where the weather was actually nicer in Shetland than it was down in London. So that was quite nice, mm-hmm. to be honest. It's always good.
I have to ask this as well, and it's a tiny question in the bigger scheme of things, but you're the person to ask, and I might never get another chance. When I'm seated on an aircraft as a passenger and the captain's voice booms out of the speaker pre-flight, regardless of whether that voice is male or female, there's always a quality or a feel about it. They speak in only a way the captain of a plane does, with that calmness and assuredness that lets you know if there was an escort of a dragon either side of the flight, this captain's not going to bat an eyelid. That pilot voice, that must be trained, is it? And for that purpose, to keep people calm.
It's one of those rare parts of being a pilot that generally comes naturally.
Really? And,
we maybe do a small amount of training in it, but it's one of those areas that, to be honest, is just assumed. Obviously during line training of a pilot, we do assess that and train it, but generally there's very little input required, and that's because most pilots know that they need to be in control. And they need to be able to get people's trust and people's, be able to reassure people. And the best way to do that is to make sure that you have a slow and calm and controlled voice. So that's generally what people do. And as I'm doing right now, sat with a microphone, three centimeters from my face, it's very similar on an aircraft. You know, generally they're quite noisy environments and you have to have a microphone very close. So you don't need to shout. You can generally kind of keep a nice, relaxed, relaxed, calm voice. But interesting, actually, one of the things we do at Loganair a lot, actually, is if there are any kind of unforeseen and unfortunate delays for weather, then one of the things we do is encourage our pilots to go out and talk to the people face to face. So okay. talk to the passengers face to face. So we'll go out into the cabin and actually speak with the passengers, looking them in the eye so that they can understand and ask questions. And if they're not on the aircraft, then I head out into the terminal building and I try and corral them around the gate and explain, you know, the reason for the delay, and that more often than not, the pilots and the cabin crew want to get home as well. So we're not delays are not something that we like either. So you know, we only do it if we have to on safety related grounds. So it's I find it really works, and that's probably something that in fact something that you very very occasionally see other airlines doing, and it quite often makes TikTok or you know, Instagram. You see pilots going out and speaking to the passengers from the front of the cabin, but that at Logan Air is something that we try and do as standard.
Yeah, it makes all the difference. What does success look like for you at Logan Air now then?
Well, that's a really interesting one, because probably the answer is that nothing noticeable happens.
In other words, nothing goes wrong.
Yeah, that's probably it. Really, if I've done my job properly, then everything just goes to plan and nobody notices, and everybody just thinks that all this stuff just happens naturally, and that it's you know, not unbelievably complex, and it's very, very simple. So that's probably my measure of success, is just everything going to plan.
There are no ripples. How does Logan Air evolve and develop its training offering? Because I'm thinking in something like aviation, I mean, I don't know how often it changes, but there will be developments both technologically and the way that people pass through airports and all that sort of thing. How do you evolve your training and develop it over the period of time?
Well, I mean, a lot of the training is regulatory. So it's mandated by law that we do it. And that generally changes very little, or if it does, it's very, very slow, cumbersome. It needs to go through, as you can imagine, a very kind of long-winded process to make sure that you know, DUF regulations not written. And then there's some elements that are less regulated, and those allow us to be a bit freer and a bit more kind of dynamic with what we do. And one of the interesting things that we've done recently actually is we've built an emergency exit training rig. Okay. Which is something that we've never had at Logan Air before, and it's sitting about 20 feet from me just now, and it's basically a complete section of fuselage of one of our ATR aircraft with the emergency exit in the side, and it allows us to train pilots and cabin crew in a very controlled environment. And previously on previous aircraft, we would just do it on the aircraft during a turnaround or at the end of a duty or at the beginning of a duty. And that worked for many years, but we've got a little bit bigger now, and that works. The kind of coordination between our engineering teams and our operations teams to make sure that aircraft are available to fly our passengers to where they want to go means that that's a lot more difficult to achieve. So we this year invested in that bit of equipment, and seems to be taking off, if I can use that phrase.
You've used that analogy, yeah.
Something that to the point where we've actually ordered a second one now, because it's been so successful. So we'll have one here in Glasgow, and we'll have another one up in Aberdeen for our pilots and cabin crew to use. And every time they have recurrent training, they come down and they actually demonstrate physically opening the exit and talk through the process and the operating procedures that we have for it. So, and allows them to actually physically do these things that generally they only talk to the passengers about doing. So it's good just to keep them in practice.
Just one other thing, one final question. And this is anecdotal more than anything, but in my observations, when I've been flying with Logan Air, it's on that airline that I would notice a female voice coming from the cockpit more than any other airline. Does that actually bear out? Is that, you know, do you have a lot of female pilots?
I think we have somewhere in the region of 13% the last time it was all counted up, I think, which is it's quite low, isn't it, really, in the grand scheme of things. It sounds very low, 13%, but
well, it
actually
depends how compared to the industry and
well, this is it, absolutely. The industry average is about 5%,
oh, right, okay.
I believe. So we actually at Logan Air have it's certainly the highest percentage of female pilots in the UK, and I think maybe even Europe, and you know, we must be fairly up there in the world, which is a great testament. We've got a long way to go, obviously, to get to the point where it should be, but I'm pleased to say that we're at the forefront rather than lagging behind in that respect.
Ronan, thanks for joining us. I'm John Mellis. That was another episode of Loganair's Flight Log, where we take the big issues of being in the air and put them on air. If you want to listen to more episodes, you'll find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you usually listen, right here, and on Loganair's own webpage. Remember, if you enjoyed Flight Log, please rate and recommend us, and please follow us if you have that option. That way, Flight Log will touch down with you whenever we publish a new episode. We'll see you next time, and thanks for listening. So we're home.